My name is Eli Harris, co-founder of R0, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Are you new to The Startup Story? Have you only discovered the show recently? If so, I'm so pumped and I'm also so appreciative to have you along for the ride. And I hope you subscribe to the show or follow the show if you use Spotify. You know, we have some amazing founders this past year and our upcoming release schedule is not showing any signs of slowing down. So you will definitely not want to miss a single episode. And there are some amazing founder tactics coming your way as well. And in fact, founder tactics are not just part of the startup story, but we share them within the pages of Grindology. Wait, hold up a second. Have you even heard of Grindology? Have you subscribed to Grindology yet? And for those who may not know, Grindology is a brand extension of the startup story, and we release a new issue of Grindology magazine every quarter. Every single issue of Grindology focuses on a very specific theme that is pertinent to all startups of all stages. And within each issue, we aggregate founder direct resources that will deliver real value and assistance to your entrepreneurial journey. Much like the startup story is about providing you with founder direct guidance, Grindology provides you with founder direct tactics and resources. And every single issue of Grindology is chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of Grindology, we'll be delivering to you tactics and strategies that you can integrate into your business immediately. Our current issue that is available right now is focused on automation. And within this issue, you will hear from a founder that shares how he drove 20% revenue growth automating their email retargeting flows. You'll also hear how to leverage automation within your hiring process so that you are not hindered during your season of exponential growth. And you will also receive the actual playbook on how Lyft built their marketing automation platform, provided directly by the senior engineering manager who built it. I'm telling you, founder direct tactics make all the difference in the world. And that is exactly what you will find in this issue and in every issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. So get your digital access to all of our issues today by visiting GrindologyMagazine.com. And of course, we'll include a link in our show notes. All right, now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Eli Harris, the co-founder of R0. The chances are incredibly high that you have never heard of R0 because they are a newer startup and have gone from idea to market in breakneck speed. R0 is disrupting an archaic industry, disinfection of all things. And in doing so, they're creating a category around health security and biosafety technology. Eli and his co-founders recognized that the COVID pandemic was going to present a massive shift in health security, much like 9/11 did for physical security.
There are certain events throughout history that just create everlasting societal and infrastructural changes. And in a dark way, we kind of liken the pandemic to 9/11. How in the wake of 9/11, we now have the whole Department of Homeland Security. You have TSA with 14,000 agents. You still can't take a water bottle or wear shoes through the airport. You go to a ball game and you have to walk through a metal detector. These are all new standards that were created and adopted post 9/11. And some of the psychological scar tissue after that event, it accelerated the adoption of those standards, but we never regressed. The world fundamentally took on a new posture around security. And our thesis was that in the wake of the pandemic, that word security is going to be broadened to biosecurity. And all organizations are going to have to uphold new standards in how they interact and respect human health of their staff, their patrons, their community at large. And we started looking at our response to the pandemic, and that was to go around with backpack sprayers and go hose buildings down with chemicals. And it is ludicrous. I mean, chemicals are horrible for the environment. They largely only address surfaces. There's a lot of human error. There's zero compliance. You still have people going around signing their names on a checklist. If you're really fancy, maybe you scan a QR code. But this industry, it is hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. It is just run by these Goliath companies, Clorox, Diversey, SC Johnson, Ecolab, Kimberly-Clark, P&G, truly hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap, and it's archaic. Every other major industry has been disrupted by technology. Where you have automotive, you have Tesla. where you have space, SpaceX, music, Spotify, content, Netflix. But nobody has ever looked at this disinfection space because nobody's cared and the demand hasn't been there, and it hasn't been sexy for entrepreneurs and engineers to go look in this space. And then also, these chemical players, they have these multi-billion dollar empires to defend.
The opportunity for Eli and the R0 team is enormous, and we discuss the societal shift in greater detail within this episode. But let me be clear, Eli's story is not one of success without failure. See, R0 is Eli's second startup, and his first is now valued over $1 billion. Yes, his first startup hit the elusive unicorn status. But yet, he doesn't get to share in that success because a little over 2 years ago, he was pushed out and let go from the very company he built. And within this episode, we unpack how he processed that very moment to get to a place where he was capable and emotionally ready to begin building what, from all external signs, looked like, it looks to be another unicorn startup story. Now, you've heard me say it since the inception of the Startup Story podcast. The entrepreneurial journey is not linear, and it rarely is it only a success chart that moves up and to the right. Yet, regardless of the trajectory my founder guest stories take, they all have an origin story that contributes to where they stand today. And that is the startup story.
Yeah, I had a very unique childhood. My father spent more than 10 years living in Kenya. My mother spent about 10 in India. My dad went just after college, my mom after high school. They came back to the States later in their lives. They met back in the States. My mom came back, she was working as a temp. She put herself through flight school, learned how to fly, and then started her own flight practice and became a flight instructor, had her own little business. She actually taught my dad to fly recreationally, and that's how they ended up forming their relationship. My dad went to Kenya when he was 21, 22, ended up staying 16 years. Wow. And he did everything from filming wildlife to trading produce and telecom equipment to shipping live crayfish to Sweden. He was doing all kinds of stuff. He came back to the States and he's kept on his entrepreneurial journey, and he did everything from putting coin-operated public showers on beaches to owning vending machines, to starting a small mini storage facility. He really taught me to hustle. And I admired that. I mean, they both worked quite a lot, but they were able to, in some sense, structure their work around mine and my siblings' life, which really made them present and involved.
Yeah.
I think they definitely helped me understand that a lot of the ideas of normal that a lot of my peers have and the conventional tracks that they get put onto are constructed, and they're not necessarily normal on a global scale. Yeah. And the folks that we had in and out, in and around our life were extremely unconventional. So it made me, I think, a little bit more comfortable carving out my own path.
So let me ask that question. Well, first off, in the years in which your family was in Africa, were you born, or was this pre-Eli?
Oh, so these were two separate journeys. These were all pre-Eli. My dad came back to the States when he was 40, because his mom was getting old and she was having some issues.
Understood.
My mom went to India and studied meditation and music and dance and bounced around different ashrams in Asia and Europe. And she came back when she was 30 to the States and started building their lives in the States independently and crossed paths. So they each had their independent journeys pre-Eli. And I was born in Santa Barbara, California, which is not a bad place to call home.
Not at all.
We did grow up on a shared property and grew up with a Nepalese family for a while, a Guatemalan woman. We kind of adopted my cousin from Venezuela, so he's really like my brother. And we had a Ukrainian group living with us for a while, and it was a very international it takes a village, definitely.
I love that. I love it. You know, one of the things that that tends to happen when we're raised by entrepreneurs, when we're raised by those who are forging their own path, is that as a child, and I'm one of those. You know, I was raised by a father who had an amazing print shop, and I saw it stolen from him, and the embezzlement that took place, and I saw what it did to him and the family. And I remember marking that. Like, it was a mental milestone in my head that I never want to be an entrepreneur, right? And there are stories where those who were raised by entrepreneurs, everything was glorious. Everything was fantastic. And therefore, that's what they knew. They wanted the freedom. They wanted the autonomy. They wanted the financial pleasures that came with it. And so for you, when you look back to your childhood, was entrepreneurship something you wanted because the way your parents modeled it? Or was it, did you see other lifestyles and therefore thought of something different for yourself?
I think I grew up, I feel like I felt capable. My parents made me believe that I was capable. And I had all kinds of fantasies, and I still do, about going into medicine or foreign service or entrepreneurship. Anything was a possibility. And I was open to the world. And it was much larger than the U.S. So as a kid, I don't know if I had a very clear idea of what I thought my life path would be. And I still don't. And I still might have a chapter in medicine or diplomacy or as a botanist. I mean, who knows? I think the most sorry for folks that think they know exactly what path they're on, because that's very limiting. Then you put blinders on to the world, where I feel like I was raised in a way, and I still operate in a way where anything is a possibility. It's just one giant whiteboard. And I like the idea of having different chapters of my life. And in the past 8 years, I've been on this very intense entrepreneurial journey, and that is the version of myself I'm playing. And it is all consuming. There's no such thing as a halfway entrepreneur, especially when you're trying to build a venture-backed business. Yeah. And this is my entire life. But I do fantasize about having periods of my life that are entirely different, where my primary focus is starting a family of my own, or health, or doing some crazy physical feats, or going back to school and learning a whole new trade. I mean, I definitely still have many fantasies about the different versions of Eli that I want to play and the different chapters of my life I want to have.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely love it. So let's talk about the natural chapter that almost every single person in the United States goes through, and that is the end of high school, right? We're coming into adulthood. For a lot of people, it means we're going to college. For some, it's a trade school. For some, I've had people on the guest where they started their first startup in high school and built it out to become WordPress, right? Matt Mullenweg's story. And so for you, coming to the end of your high school years, what did you think your future was?
At that time, I already believed in this idea of carving out my own path and blazing my own trail, and I doing something on a global scale and something of impact and meaning. And I subscribe to these kind of buzzwords and philosophies that I think a lot of my peers do. But for me, it was less of a fantasy and more of a plan. And I like the idea of not having fantasies, not having ideas, but just creating plans and setting yourself on that journey. And you can always pivot. You can always change your mind. We have that luxury. We have that free will. But I had very clear plans of building a life of meaning, of impact, of consequence, of that was unique, unconventional, global. I felt already from an early age that I didn't want to just subscribe to a conventional track. I didn't know what form that would take, but I felt compelled to contribute in my own way to the world. I didn't want to do something where I felt replaceable. Mm-hmm. I felt like if I was doing a job that somebody else could be hired for, then it wasn't my own unique value that I was contributing to the world. And then one thing my dad always said to me, and I don't always listen to him. I rarely do in my professional journey. But one thing he did tell me is, if you're doing a job you're qualified for, you're doing the wrong job, because then you're not growing, you're not learning. And that always stuck in the back of my head. And I loved that. I loved it.
Oh, that's fantastic. So as you're not having a framework, if you will, for what your future is, and you don't want to be bound to anything, you know, and wanting to contribute something great into this world, did that lead you to your first startup?
Yeah. In university, I started studying Chinese. I thought I maybe wanted to work in diplomacy. I think languages are very powerful. It was a little bit arbitrary. I was thinking, okay, maybe Chinese, maybe Arabic. What's the most valuable language I could learn? I met a few of the teachers, and I I just happened to really like the Chinese teacher. I signed up for Intro to Chinese my freshman year of college, and it was really hard. And I liked it, and I liked the challenge, and I was pretty good, but it was tough. And I learned as much as you do in 1 year in a classroom. And I acknowledged the commitment it would take to really master this language.
Yeah.
And if I was going to make that commitment, I wanted to make sure I liked being in China. So one fortunate thing about being in university or college is there's often a lot of free money if you look for it. Mm. And I didn't have a family background where my folks could just send me wherever I wanted and I can sign up for X, Y, and Z program. I had to, well, my parents, gave me a great childhood. In my adult life, I've had to fight for everything on my own. Mm. And there is a lot of free money out there. And I was given a scholarship to go to China for free, all expenses paid after my freshman year. And I was able to teach English in exchange for free Mandarin courses there.
That's awesome.
And the truth is, I just had fun. And I feel like people always expect some nuanced answer about, you know, some realization I had or some fascination I took with some aspect of my experience there. But the truth is, I just had the time of my life. I was 18. I was in China. I was living on my own in this country. I'd never been there before. I felt special. Everyone and I would try to speak Chinese, and it was validated. And I could barely speak a few words at that point, but I got attention, and I fed off that, and I thrived off that. It was a positive validation circle, and I ended up ditching the last several weeks of the program and went backpacking across China, and I found myself in some pretty precarious situations. But I just had so much fun that I went back to school that next year with a renewed commitment. And I said, I don't know in what capacity, but I have an opportunity here to make myself valuable and open doors and go on this journey in life that few people do. So I came back with this tenacity around learning Chinese. Hmm. And the remainder of my college experience, it was largely focused on China and anything to do with China, whether that was from a history, politics, economics, or the language. I found free money every single summer, and a whole semester. I ended up finding my way to China for free and doing various programs or internships or academic courses. And then I ended up doing a couple Fulbrights, actually, which was okay. I did two separate Fulbright scholarships. And at this time, I was thinking, you know what, maybe I want to work in diplomacy. I was speaking Chinese pretty darn fluently. And I'm proud of that because I worked really hard for that. And I was feeling valuable, and doors were just opening just because I was willing to be there and put myself out there. And I was thinking maybe I want to work foreign service or diplomacy, but I was kind of rosy-eyed and naive. and through my time at Fulbright, you know, I thought that my own convictions about the world, I could influence political relations, or I can shape this global generation of youth that don't see borders and kumbaya and happily ever after. You know, we collaborate and we're all one world. But what I didn't realize is, working in foreign service, you have a fiduciary duty to a national mandate. You are there to execute a mandate. Your own convictions are totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
So I started to pivot from those ideas of working in public service, but just being in China, just doors kept opening. And I walked into a hotel in Shanghai, and I saw somebody in a Santa Barbara t-shirt. Turns out we had a bunch of mutual connections, and he was on the board of FLIR, which is the largest thermal imaging company in the world. And I told him about what I was doing in China, and he was intrigued and impressed and proud of that courage and journey. And then he brought me to a couple of his meetings. I called in sick at my Fulbright program. I shadowed him to a couple of meetings. I ended up meeting DJI, the drone company, through him, and then ended up finding my way into a job at DJI, the world's largest drone company based in Shenzhen, China. And I moved to Shenzhen with one suitcase. It's a city of 14 million people. I had never been there in my life. I accepted the job and I bought a one-way ticket and I went to Shenzhen. And I ended up, at the time, DJI had more than 3,000 employees. They had 80% of the global drone market. Wow. They had less than a dozen non-Chinese employees in Shenzhen.
Wow.
And again, just being there and speaking Chinese and being competent enough and projecting confidence, I was given these responsibilities and authority and respect that I never could have commanded at my age in the U.S. And I got to help DJI build their entire commercial business in Europe and North America. I flew to 16 countries in less than a year, meeting with executives from Fortune 500 companies, speaking on behalf of DJI, and I was having the time of my life. And it was a heck of an experience.
I love that. Now, how old were you, or how old and what year was this experience at DJI?
It was 2015, and I was 22 years old.
That's incredible. That is incredible.
And then when I was 23, I was there only about a year and a half. And I got to know two battery engineers, two Chinese nationals on the battery engineering team quite well, because I was working on commercial drones. And if you're a hobbyist flying a drone to take selfies on the beach, I mean, 20 minutes is great. If you're mapping an oil pipeline or looking for a missing person, I mean, you got to keep a drone in the air much longer.
Yeah.
So as that was my my focus, I worked very closely with those battery engineers. I got to know them very well. I liked them. I trusted them. And we started conceiving of in the field, lithium ion, solar rechargeable drone recharging stations. As we started learning about that concept, we started thinking about the entire market of gas generators and how this is really not a problem unique to drones. This is industry category application agnostic. This idea of having portable, industrial amounts of portable power. The market for gas generators is over $1 billion. Honda, of their Honda 2000 gas generator, they sell $1.5 billion a year of those gas generators.
Wow.
And every other industry is moving towards batteries, whether it's grid storage, whether it's vehicles, transportation, whether it's power tools. Everybody's moving electric batteries, but there's so much more money in those large grid vehicle endeavors that nobody's ever looked at this portable space. So the three of us ended up quitting DJI and we went on this mission to build a venture to build 1.5 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery packs that packed an industrial amount of power and to sell them for use in the field, whether it's construction or camping or flying drones or whatever it is that you're doing. Yeah. And the mission was to replace the traditional gas generator. I was the CEO of the business. I was the first one to leave. And I for 4.5 years, I was the CEO of that company. I worked my butt off. I was living in Shenzhen. It was my identity. I worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. We grew the company to over 100 employees. Mm. We built two manufacturing plants from scratch. We shipped 200,000 products to 37 countries. Wow. And we were growing fast, and we kind of subscribed to this model, the Silicon Valley model of raise, spend, growth at all costs. Yeah. And while we had built a pretty large business in 4 years, and I was the CEO, and at that time I was recognized by Forbes as Forbes 30 under 30, and I was getting all these public accolades, and the company was doing well. And then it was the height of the trade wars between Chairman Xi and President Trump, and all of these tariffs were tacked onto our products. The capital markets tightened greatly, and we had to raise more money, and our unit economics weren't as great, and we were out of money, and we were struggling, and we found some potential investors, and with that raise, I was actually pushed out and let go from my own company.
Wow.
So I had spent 4 years as CEO. This was my identity. This was my whole life. I mean, and I built something of value, over 100 employees, two manufacturing plants. We were doing millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars of business. Yeah. And it was everything. And I just didn't even realize that something like that could happen. And I was given the opportunity of I was pushed out, and I was offered a nominal buyout. And I was scared. I was back in the States. I was kicked out of this company. We were struggling. It was the trade wars. We were running out of money. They offered me a buyout, and I was scared, and I felt powerless, and I said yes. And for my age, it was a decent liquidity event. I was given a little bit of breathing room, but far from the value I created. And I came back to the States, and I moved back in with my dad. I started seeing a therapist. I mean, it was my whole identity.
Yeah. Let me ask, I want to unpack that, you know, to as much as you will grant me, I want to unpack that season a bit. Cause I also know, you know, for myself and for many of the other founders that I've had on the show, these moments, are sometimes tough to unpack, but I also think for my listening audience, they need to understand how nonlinear the entrepreneurial journey is, and how, while the headlines that we read about successful startups paint the great side of the venture, the rosy side of the journey, there's so much more before it that takes place that we don't get really a privilege to understand until we hear interviews like this. And so when you think back to that season, first off, mechanically, were you pushed out because the venture capital firm said, hey, I'm assuming one Chinese venture capital, were you pushed out, one, because you were not a national, and two, was part of it part of the terms of the investments that we will invest only if Eli is removed from this position? Was that part of the mechanics of that push out?
I can't speak to that with entire accuracy. Okay. I didn't get that visibility. Got and it. At that point, I was removed from the process. It very much felt that way to me.
Okay. Okay.
So whether that was how prescriptive that was, but I mean, my two co-founders from China, I mean, one of them, I was the best man at their wedding. The other one, I was the godfather of his kid. I mean, this was so far from the scope of realities I imagined.
Yeah.
And it was traumatizing and humiliating. And, but we were all scared. I mean, we all put money into this. We put our whole lives into this, and for so long I was so angry at them. But I don't know if I fault them. We were scared, and the company was struggling.
Yeah.
But what's wild is now, in the past year and a half since my departure, I mean, they've really turned the business around, and the company is now valued over $1 billion. It's now a unicorn. And part of me is so angry and resentful that I don't get to share in that financial success.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to own the fact nobody can take away from me the fact that I started that company.
Yes.
And I need to own that. And for so long, I talked to therapists, business coaches, mentors, friends, girlfriends, parents, and everybody would tell me that the journey I went on, it was that is the success, and it's the experience and the doors that opens and what that will lead to. And logically, I knew that to be true.
Yeah.
Logically, I knew it's not about the money. It's about the journey. It's about the experience, and about the growth that I had. And I totally believe that from an objective, logical perspective. But my feelings were never able to catch up to that logic.
Yes.
So I had the self-awareness to acknowledge this incredible journey I went on, but I was still just full of anger. Yes. And I think it's only been now on this, it's only been the past several months, really, as I've embarked on this new venture, that I've finally been able to acknowledge the only reason I'm even participating in this new venture, and that we're now on this incredible trajectory that we're on with the incredible people I'm doing it with. It is only because I had that last experience. And if that last experience went any different way, it would not have led me to this one. And what I'm doing now, and the people I'm doing it with, and the trajectory that we're on, is it's a whole nother magnitude of not just financial prospect, but the growth I'm having, the meaning I'm finding, the person I'm becoming is one that I'm proud of. And it's very different from where I was a year and a half ago. So only now my feelings are catching up.
I love that. And I hope everyone listening caught that, because you know, one of the things that Eli said when he was unpacking his departure out of that startup was his identity was wrapped in it, right? And the realization is that no matter what we build, no matter how successful it is or how much of a failure it is never our identity. Like it just isn't. And we misplace our identity in that. And until you were removed from it, you were able to see and acknowledge that, okay, that's not who I was. That's what I did. That's what I accomplished. And you're right. And, you know, having gone through tremendous failure myself multiple times, each one has been processed a bit differently because of what I previously went through and realizing that it's not my identity. The journey truly does matter. The lessons play into what my next venture is. But I want to ask you, you sounds like your recovery was a bit faster than mine was. So why did you decide to get back on the horse after a year and a half after this event versus maybe going back into the idea of diplomacy or serving as an employee at DJI, not DJI specifically, but a company like DJI that had Chinese roots because of all the success you had before it, right? Because, you know, you had tremendous success up until this very moment where the firm booted you. And so that was your first point of failure that we've heard so far. So why was your response not to go back to where you found success, but to continue on pushing through the area that brought obstacles for you?
That's a good question. I grieved for a year and a half prior to this R0 journey, my current venture, but I'm still grieving. I mean, it's not like it's all in the past. I mean, I think you can hear in my voice the emotion. I mean, I still have a lot of, I get waves of anger, humiliation, resentment, confusion. I mean, I am still working through these feelings. I do know that it led me to where I am now, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. But that doesn't erase the hurt that I do feel. I try to channel that to fuel me, and I think part of the answer to your question is I feel like I got so close to sharing the success of the last venture. I have a chip on my shoulder. I want to prove that I can. I want to know that I can. I think I'm as much trying to prove that to them as I am to myself, as I am to the world. And I know it needs to be an internal job. I mean, doing it to prove a point to anyone else is, I will never achieve that. It will never be enough. I got to prove it to myself, but I want to know that I can build something successful on my own or not on my own, but with others. But as painful as the dissolution was, the perspective it gave me, the experiences I've had, I mean, there were just so many amazing moments throughout that journey that made me who I am and just gave me a exposure to the world and to life. And it forced me to grow up in ways that, and I also had some of the best times of my life. Yes, it ended sourly, but it showed me the kind of life I could have.
I love it. Oh, Eli, that is so powerful and so helpful for all those listening. And even for myself, like, I'm reprocessing a lot of things from my own personal journey, and I am better for it in hearing your processing as well. So thank you for that. But this journey does lead us to R0, which is why we are talking today. And I'm super pumped to be talking to you about it. One, because I really, and most of my audience knows, like, and I've said it numerous times, like, there's no prepared questions. This is two entrepreneurs having a conversation. So hearing all your life journey up to this point makes me even more excited to hear about what you're doing now with R0. So for my audience, who probably has no idea what R0 is, can you share with them what R0 is and what it is you're trying to accomplish?
Absolutely. So we are really reinventing and modernizing the entire disinfection industry. So this started as a COVID response play.
Before we continue on, I want to jump in here and ask you to be very intentional as you hear Eli unpack the R0 story. See, when I heard Eli's story for the first time, my brain was working overtime because I began to think through all the industries that the R0 solution will help. I then, because I love supporting entrepreneurs, began to think about all the people that I could introduce to Eli within those industries or brands. And I'm 100% confident that you will think the same way as Eli shares about the R0 offering. And as a fellow entrepreneur, I am asking you to show up for Eli in that way. If you have a connection or a second tier connection with someone within an industry or organization that needs to know about the R0 solution, reach out to him on LinkedIn and offer to make that introduction. R0 is growing like crazy, but they are still early and revenue is king. I know you know this. So let's make sure we don't listen passively, but listen with the intent to support a fellow founder. And of course, we'll include a link to his LinkedIn bio in our show notes so you can connect with him. But let's get back to Eli's startup story.
So this started as a COVID response play, and it snowballed into something much, much bigger than we ever anticipated as we've learned more about this opportunity. So I have two partners in the business, Grant Morgan and Ben Boyer, both of whom I just truly, truly admire and have grown to love and respect, not just as professionals and business partners, but also as people, just the way they operate in the world. I learn from every day, and I respect and I admire. And I actually met Grant 7 years ago when I was at DJI. He was working on his first startup, iCracked, and we conceptualized and discussed a partnership between DJI and his company, iCracked, but the partnership never materialized. But we just became fast friends and stayed in touch through the years. And Ben Boyer was actually an investor in and on the board of Grant's company, iCracked. I had my dissolution from my first venture at the same time that Grant exited his company, iCracked, to Allstate. So we were all free agents at the time. And when the pandemic happened, Ben, Grant, and I got together. This was in March of 2020. My co-founders and I started talking about how there are certain events throughout history that just create everlasting societal and infrastructural changes. And in a dark way, we kind of liken the pandemic to 9/11. How in the wake of 9/11, we now have the whole Department of Homeland Security. You have TSA with 14,000 agents. You still can't take a water bottle or wear shoes through the airport. You go to a ball game and you have to walk through a metal detector. These are all new standards that were created and adopted post 9/11. And some of the psychological scar tissue after that event, it accelerated the adoption of those standards, but we never regressed. The world fundamentally took on a new posture around security. And our thesis was that in the wake of the pandemic, that word security is going to be broadened to biosecurity. And all organizations are going to have to uphold new standards in how they interact and respect human health of their staff, their patrons, their community at large. And we started looking at our response to the pandemic, and that was to go around with backpack sprayers and go hose buildings down with chemicals. And it is ludicrous. I mean, chemicals are horrible for the environment. They largely only address surfaces. There's a lot of human error. There's zero compliance. You still have people going around signing their names on a checklist. If you're really fancy, maybe you scan a QR code. But this industry, it is hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. It is just run by these Goliath companies, Clorox, Diversey, SC Johnson, Ecolab, Kimberly-Clark, P&G, truly hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap, and it's archaic. Every other major industry has been disrupted by technology. Where you have automotive, you have Tesla. Where you have space, SpaceX, music, Spotify, content, Netflix. But nobody has ever looked at this disinfection space because nobody's cared and the demand hasn't been there, and it hasn't been sexy for entrepreneurs and engineers to go look in this space. And then also, these chemical players, they have these multi-billion dollar empires to defend. And especially in the pandemic, they've built up even more production capacity, and they're going to defend that with their dear lives because that's a very successful business. But in 1918, we used chemicals as a response to the Spanish flu. More than 100 years later, we're using the same chemical formulas. It has not changed. So we actually got in touch with Dr. Richard Wade. And Dr. Wade is the former executive director of Cal OSHA. He actually ran Cal OSHA for 15 years. And Dr. Wade led us on a study of hospitals to try to understand what do hospitals do well at preventing infection, and why has that not been democratized to all other shared spaces? And we learned that hospitals do have some good practices, but the pricing is an artifact of our healthcare system. It has nothing to do with technologies, what it costs to build them, and implement them. Hospitals have a huge financial liability to remediate HAIs, hospital-acquired infections. And anytime there's an infection on their premises, that's typically a $40,000 financial liability. So the manufacturers of these effective infection prevention technologies, they come into these spaces and they say, you know what? Forget the product. We're not selling you the product. There's an overwhelming body of evidence that shows the impact this will have on your infection in your premises. And we're going to price this to you based on the cost savings of preventing infections. And when we realized that, we went out and we raised more than $60 million from DBL, the fund of SpaceX and Tesla, and John Doerr, who's the first backer in Google and Amazon. And we went out and we raised a lot of money. And in 5 months, we engineered a system that outcompetes any system being sold in the hospital today. And we're pricing it based off the bill of materials, not extorting value from the healthcare system. So that was the inception point. And in 9 months, we've done tens of millions of dollars in sales. And it's been unbelievable, the traction that we received. And as we've dove further into this space, we realized how much more opportunity there is to get even smarter about infection prevention. So now we're on this mission to create continuous automated systems of disinfection that have real-time audit trails, and we can statistically model out, improve the reduction in viral load and risk in any indoor space, and then offer a system that lowers that risk, and then prove through clinical and observational studies what health outcomes will be achieved, whether that's higher attendance in schools, whether that's better student performance, whether it's fewer sick days and hospital visits and higher productivity for employees, or reduced infections in a healthcare-related setting. So the opportunity we have here to offer better solutions with fairly simple technologies to do a better job at mitigating risk in any indoor space, not only are we able to keep people safer, but we're starting to learn that there actually is a lot of financial value in reducing healthcare-related incidents.
That is amazing. Like, I mean, as you were just talking about all of the things that of the industry you're trying to disrupt, and then of course all of the, I'm gonna call it what it is, the corruption when it comes to capitalizing off of healthcare. I mean, that's a whole other podcast. Like, there are certain systems in place that I think are just absolutely corrupt. I think academia is one of them. I think healthcare is another one. But again, a different podcast for that. But one of the things, as you were talking about these behemoths that you're going up against, right? I go back to the very first time that someone tried to create the electric car. You know, early 90s, maybe late 80s. And the bigs shot it down, right? Big Oil came in and just kept pumping through why the electric car wasn't going to happen. In fact, I think there's a Netflix documentary of it. Is there any concern that the heavy hitters within the chemical space might somehow try to create, again, they got lobbyists, right? Create legislation as to why your solution doesn't meet the healthcare provisions. Is there any concern that the weight of the dollar from these massive heavyweights might come in and be an obstacle to what it is you're trying to disrupt?
Oh, they're going to come at us with the kitchen sink. They're going to come in swinging with everything they have, all of their political clout. And I mean, they have a massive empire to defend. But at the end of the day, it's science. And I think we're onto something really special, and we're proving it out. And we have lab tests to back it up, and we have clinical studies upcoming. And at the end of the day, it is science. And we're about to, I can't divulge too much yet. We're about to make a few announcements. We just bought one company. We're about to buy two more. And we're about to close an investment from one of the most noteworthy institutions in the medical field in the world. And the scientific community is getting behind the type of work that we're doing. I think a lot of folks are starting to realize that the way we've been doing things is outdated. Mm. And there is a lot of opportunity here. And at the end of the day, I hope we are a community and a country that does believe in science. So, I mean, we're able to show through modeling and through lab tests that the technology is effective. And now the mission is we're doing a few clinical studies right now. And again, they will be announced publicly soon, so I can't divulge too much, but We're working with one of the largest school districts in the country, and we're deploying our solutions in a certain set of experiment schools against some control schools. And we're actually going to do a year-long study to show how creating healthier indoor spaces can actually impact student performance. If we can keep kids in the classroom, if we can statistically lower the risk of getting sick, and if we can increase attendance there, a couple things. One, schools are funded based on attendance. They're funded based on butts in seats every day. They're also funded based on student performance. And there's an overwhelming body of science around the impact of attendance on student performance. So if we can create healthier spaces that keep kids in the classroom, how will that translate to student performance? And the byproduct of that, not only can we reshape the education of American youth, it also results in more funding for the schools. So we're also able to bring more funding to our education system. We're doing something similar in senior care, looking at how these systems can impact occupancy, looking at the business of senior care, but also the longevity and the lifetime of their residents, as well as the empirical data around the number of infections that incur on those premises. And we're also looking at doing one in corporate real estate. So looking at office spaces, and can we actually materially impact sick days? Because all large corporations, if you have more than 2,700 employees, it makes more economic sense to be self-insured, which means that you are paying a lot of the healthcare-related expenses for your own employees. So if we can materially reduce visits to doctors, hospitals for their staff, that is a cost savings for that company, not to mention the productivity gains of keeping people in the office. So not only is there this humongous opportunity to actually impact human lives and keep people alive or keep them healthy and stop them from getting the seasonal flu, the common cold, we're starting to learn the financial impact it can have on any type of organization. Because I wish people would do it because it's the right thing to do. Yeah. But unfortunately, there often needs to be an economic driver. And, yeah. and luckily, in this case, there seems to be both. But 40 million people a year get the seasonal flu. And we've just accepted that as normal. But the truth is, we can take practices that impact that and mitigate it. It's a $17 billion a year problem for the U.S., the seasonal flu. Just in the U.S., $17 billion a year. Wow. We spend $600 billion a year on healthcare. That's 20% of our GDP. Wow. If we can make even a fractional impact on that, it's billions of dollars.
I hope those listening will visit r0.com to learn more and to see what the unit is and how the technology works. But for those who are driving that don't have access to the show notes to see, to click through the website, see what the unit is. Can you explain how the technology works and how might those of that are interested acquire a unit for themselves?
Yeah, so the core technology is UVC. And UVC is extremely old technology. In 1903, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was awarded for the discovery of UVC. And it's a certain wavelength of light that can penetrate the cell walls of any microorganism, and it ruptures the RNA or DNA so that it can't reproduce. So you render it inactive, you kill. Whereas a HEPA filter will filter out particles, but unfortunately a lot of viruses pass through those filters. UVC will kill any virus, bacteria, mold, fungi. There is no known organism on the planet that is UVC resistant. And the sun produces UVA, B, and C. UVA is like a black light you see in a nasty hotel room video. UVB is a tanning bed. UVC is produced by the sun, but it never penetrates the Earth's atmosphere. And because of that, no organism in the world has ever evolved to resist it. And that is why it is so dangerous. It can inoculate anything. That said, it also is unsafe to human skin and eyes. So it needs to be used and leveraged in a way where you can guarantee the safety of individuals. And a lot of what we've engineered are very novel safety applications that are very effective at disinfecting spaces, air, and surfaces, and we can prevent any human exposure.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. And to hear about the growth and the success, like, and what it is you're trying to solve. And you're, again, I go back to your reference points to 9/11 and how there were just enormous societal shifts. And you're right, the pandemic is one of them. And I can see R0 being on the forefront of a really key shift as we look to really, you know, we'll say biosecurity, like you had mentioned it. When you think to your previous venture in China and what you're doing now, what are some, if maybe just one key lesson from your time and your previous venture in China that you have carried over as you're building R0?
I think this is often said, but it is so true, is that the most important aspect is the team and the people. And I find that if you can effectively give people the right context, then you can give them all the autonomy and freedom in the world. And I think the most important thing is surrounding yourself with the right people and giving them the right context. And if you can do that, it's leverage. And building a company, it's an impossible feat. It is very, very hard. It is hard to do alone. It is hard to do with a team. And you need to find ways to get leverage. And one way of doing that is bringing together the right people and having the right cadences for information sharing and getting everyone the right context they need in order to do the best job that they can.
When you look at your personal strengths, right, we're all given a set of strengths and we also carry a set of weaknesses, you know, that, and we surround ourselves by those whose strengths are our weaknesses. For you, what is your strength? Is your strength in the 0 to, you know, 100 million revenue point, maybe say 0 to 40,000 units sold? Is your strength in the scaling of it? Where do your strengths lie?
I like to think I'm good at bringing people together and rallying around ideas and evangelizing ideas. And I think I do have a fairly good business acumen. I acknowledge I am not an experienced commercial operator. And I think I'm a pretty smart kid and I could probably learn how to be, but I don't really want to. That doesn't interest me. I think I am good at bringing the right people together and getting them in the right places. I am not the operator. That is Grant. That is my partner, Grant. And he is a heck of an operator. He is phenomenal. He is merciless. And I will never be that. And I stood up all of our initial sales and marketing. But now we've brought on a real CMO, a real head of revenue, who actually know how to commercialize and scale those operations. I was good at creating chaos and getting initial traction and kicking up dust and getting people excited and just getting movement, just driving the business forward. And that is largely what I'm doing. It's just in any capacity, whether that's in supplier relations, manufacturing relations, in sales, in marketing, in hiring, I like to think that I'm a good evangelist, ambassador, just driving the business forward. But I acknowledge I am not the one, and I don't think I ever will be the one to actually run the business. I can find people much smarter and better than I am at each of those functions, whatever they are.
And I think that is what has made you successful in doing what you're doing, is that you recognize where your strengths are. And as you were describing your strengths, I was thinking from a contextual perspective, the orchestra conductor, right? They know who the best are in each section, brass, strings, winds. Like, they know who the best musicians are and they bring them together to create something so powerful and so something that resonates with us deeply. And your entrepreneurial journey, it is very clear that that is a gifting you have. And it was exciting to hear from you and to learn from you. And so if we're having a Where Are They Now episode, let's say we're just gathering 24 months from now, where will R0 be?
We will be a very big company. We're about a year and a half old. We're imminently about to cross 100 employees. I think we'll probably be close to 300 by the end of next year. That's not including the acquisitions we just made and are about to make. We're moving into the installed asset space, the built environment. So our upcoming products, it's a combination of sensors and fixtures that can do autonomous real-time disinfection, measure risk in real time. We are moving fast. I think that I mean, we are directly competitive with all of the large chemical players. We are adjacently competitive or likely partners to all of the big building players, the Honeywells, Johnson Controls, Siemens, Schneider Electric. We are about to poke multiple 800-pound gorillas.
That's awesome.
It's we got our gloves on and we're ready to partner, to battle and do what we got to do. But I think there's a massive opportunity to really impact a lot of human lives and get a lot smarter about how we keep people safe.
I love it. You know, as I'm sitting here listening to how big of an opportunity R0 has and what an innovative solution. Again, like you said, very old technology, but brought into a current space that is incredibly innovative. And obviously all the technology that wraps around it. I'm reminded about, and you've said it before, like building a business is impossible. Like it is so challenging and so complicated. So I want to get your perspective on the idea of entrepreneurship. You know, media has sensationalized entrepreneurship to the point that anybody and everybody will have an idea and they think it's a business idea. And so they tend to move forward on it. Do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur? Not everyone wants to be. I recognize that. But for those who want to be, do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur?
I do, in that entrepreneurship can take on different forms. I think anyone can be and should be. And I think that generally speaking, likely for this audience and a lot of our peers, the stakes aren't that high. I feel like we imagine a lot of constraints about, you know, maybe my employment contract is this long, or I have a lease on my apartment, or what if I fail and what will anyone else think? And I mean, even for me, I left and I moved back in with my dad, you know, and I feel like the stakes aren't actually that low for us. And I think that through that experience, you learn, and whatever you go in, whatever objective you go in with, you're probably wrong and it's probably going to change and your ideas will change and you will change. But I think anybody can put themselves out there and take that leap. I don't think there are that many legitimate real risks for most of us. We're fortunate. Most of us likely live in a country that we have some basic support and we have family or friends. And I think, yes, anyone can be an entrepreneur. What journey that ends up leading you on, who knows? Building a company is really effing hard, really hard. It is not for the faint of heart. It is not sexy, but anyone can take that leap and it will put you on some journey. And I would imagine at someday, as I'm starting to now, I'll look back on even the hard parts of that journey fondly.
Oh, I love it. You know, one of the other narratives that I like to address and break down is the idea that entrepreneurship is lonely, and it can be. I don't believe it should be intended to be that way, but for sometimes we tend to isolate ourselves. And the way that in which I do that is I focus in on all the people that have supported you in your journey. So when you think across your life, who were all the people that you look to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you are today?
I do feel very fortunate. I feel like I grew up in enabling communities. I had family, I had friends, I had teachers, I had mentors, I had colleagues, I had co-founders. I find that people are generally supportive when you have positive ambitions and plans and ideas and fantasies. And I think that if you really put yourself out there and you are vulnerable and you ask for help, most folks are willing to help and they'll be encouraging and supportive. Yeah, it is because of other people who I met along the journey that shaped me into who I am and created this journey for me. I mean, starting from my high school economics teacher, Jamie DeVries, and he started a nonprofit which was entirely student run. And I got to play a role in that. And that was my first time really feeling like an entrepreneur and feeling ownership of creating something of value that had impact. And he's still in my life today. When I left my journey with EcoFlow, my first venture, I went back to my old high school and I volunteered in his class. And he's still there teaching entrepreneurship and economics. And I got to work with some students there. And at some point in my life, I would like to make that a bigger part of my life. And then going to college, I mean, my first Chinese teacher, Teng Laoshi. She was just phenomenal, and she really encouraged me on my journey, and it was hard, and she would have lunches with me a couple times a week outside of class just to help me get better and improve myself. And then Jason Kung is a good friend and peer mentor. He was the one who gave me my first scholarship to go to China after my freshman year. He was 28 years old. He was an entrepreneur. He had been very successful, and he started his own scholarship program at 28 years old to fund 8 different kids from 8 different countries to go to China on this journey to teach English and learn Chinese. And he's still in my life today as well. I talk to him monthly. Jeff Frank was the gentleman from Santa Barbara who's on the board of FLIR, who I met in the hotel in Shanghai. And he's the one that led to my job at DJI, which ended up opening my entire journey with DJI and EcoFlow. And he's still in my life today. And he actually is one of our seed investors in my new venture, R0. So he stayed a part of this. And I even spent some time living with him during my year and a half of struggles. And even though he guided me on my first entrepreneurial journey and it failed, he still had the heart to support and invest in me going on this new journey with R0. And then, of course, I have to say, even though as much as it pains me to say it, it's because of my co-founders in my first venture, Bruce Wong, Frank Jung, Hannah Sieber, that gave me that opportunity with my first venture that I was eventually pushed out of. I mean, they went to war with me, and we had that battle together, and we had that journey together, and it's because of that and the work that we all did together that I am where I am now. And then, of course, my two partners now, Ben Boyer and Grant Morgan. I think every day I have a little bit of imposter syndrome. I mean, I look up to them both so much, and we're all equal partners, but I do admire them, and I love them, and they're both a stage ahead in personal life and professional life. They're just several years older than I am, and I have to work every day to remind myself that we're equals on this journey, because I just love them so much, and I do admire them, and they do nothing but empower me and make me feel like I am a core member of this team. And this is a collaborative journey. I think it's such a hard thing to do. And as I started with, I mean, it takes a village to raise a kid. It also takes a village to raise an adult. So I think I'm still on that journey, and I'm very thankful for everyone that's supporting me.
I love it. I absolutely love that question. If the show ever had to be trimmed down, that question would not be one of them. It is so powerful for people to hear how many individuals they look at it with such levels of success that they've had people that supported them. They poured into them. Like it is not a solo journey, and it shouldn't be. Even the Elon Musks, who put on the persona of individual, like there are people that they look to with such immense gratitude for where they're at. You know, and as we bring the show to a close, I would have loved the opportunity to have all my listeners reach out to you, connect with you, maybe receive some mentorship from you, or maybe just ask their questions directly to you. But at this scale, it's unreasonable. You know, so what I would like for you to spend a few moments talking to, let's say, the persona of the entrepreneur who's listening right now, who has an idea, they've made a little bit of traction on it, but they too are entering into a space that is so gigantic that all the outside voices are saying, why bother? You're going to get squashed by whatever the behemoths are. Try something else. Play smaller. Focus on a different demographic and industry. What would you say to that person who's wrestling with those outside voices right now?
I would tell them to just start doing it. Because as I said before, the stakes aren't that high. And if it works out, great. You know, screw those voices. And if it doesn't, it's going to lead you to the next one. And whatever that next one will be even greater.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value Eli Harris brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So with that in mind, I want to emphasize the call to action I mentioned earlier within this episode. Right now, R0 is in growth mode. So if you have enterprise contacts that you can introduce R0 to, please reach out to Eli on LinkedIn to make those introductions. And I will include a link to his LinkedIn profile in our show notes. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs, and this show of support costs you nothing. And speaking of support, I have a personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to this show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story.